Please join me in welcoming my dear, dear friend, Dan Sachs.
Thank you. Okay, well, here are some of the things Bobby forgot. If I have a reputation in this industry, it was based on these activities, having written for several publications and spending some time on the Standards Committee in its early years. What I want to focus on, though, is the last item there. I wrote for many, many years. Probably that was the publication I was with the longest. First it was embedded systems programming, then it morphed into embedded systems design, and then, like all of those publications, it went out of print. And what's left is the Cheshire Cat, the website, embedded.com. But before I get into that, you know, I'm going to be rambling on about a whole bunch of things. And like any good teacher, what I want to do is make sure that you walk away with at least one important lesson that you will remember. And so I'll just tell you what it is at the beginning, and I'll remind you several times during the talk that the title of the talk is Talking to C Programmers About C++. It's going to be about persuasion. And there's a very fundamental rule, which is when it comes to persuasion, if you're arguing, you're losing. If you find yourself butting heads, you've already lost. You will not persuade the person you would like to persuade to engage you in whatever the common thought is. And we will revisit this multiple times during the day. So anyway, along the way, I just found myself with an interest. See, I really consider myself to be a language person. It often turns out that people say, he's an expert in embedded systems, and I'm not sure what that means. But I really try to clarify this by saying, no, I really consider myself more to be a language maven who happens to have an affinity for the kinds of problems that people encounter in embedded systems. And when I started out dabbling in that, there was really only one choice for writing that stuff, and it was assembler. And by the late 1970s, C became an increasingly viable choice. In fact, my first dabbling in embedded systems was in 1979 using C, one of the first projects using C outside of Bell Labs. And then sometime, it's hard to pin down, in the mid-1990s, people started paying attention to the possibility of using C++ and embedded. And that's about the time I started speaking at the Embedded Systems Conference, and for a while there, I sort of cornered the market on giving C++ talks to an embedded audience. And the curious thing is, this is a confession, is I've never built an industrial strength embedded system out of C++. It was all done in C. And I was doing it before anybody else was. I was really coming up with, here's how I think you can apply it. And I found myself making a career out of doing vicarious programming. People would come to me and say, how do I solve this problem? I've never actually done it, but knowing what I know about the problem domain and knowing what I know about the tool set, here's how I would combine them to solve the problem. And for years, I've been getting positive feedback about my suggestions. I've a remarkable track record about being right and not being wrong too often about that. But of course, it's the mistakes is how you learn. Anyway, when embedded systems design went out of print, they asked me to write a last special article for the print column. And so I tried to figure out what would be something interesting and different from my readers. And I realized that for years, the publisher of the magazine had been giving readers surveys. And one of the questions that really interested me was the answer to the question, my current embedded project is mostly written in. And so I collected all the data and compiled it into a chart, and here's what I found. And I think this is and by the way, this chart has been updated since then with 2 more years of data. And this is a sampling of the readership of the largest publication in the embedded world. So look at the top line. That's C. And you can see the trend line. See, actually, by the way, I should add, they changed the question. They'd been asking this question since the mid-90s. And the first time they asked, the first few years they asked the question, they said, list all the languages you're using. And during on that graph, the trend lines were actually a little bit different. C was heading down, and C++ was heading up. But in 2005, it turned, and it went like that. So it's hard to suss out, gee, was it the nature of the question, or was it something that actually happened? But in any event, this is the best data I've got. And it's disturbing data. If you happen to be supportive of C++, it's not a good trend. And what you see there is C is dominating, and it's increasing. Its usage is increasing. And C++ is a distant second. And in this market, the indicators keep suggesting that the usage is actually going down. And to some extent, this is a statistical summary of the failure of my career. Because, see, I sort of backed away from standards work because I thought there was an interesting problem to be solved here, which was to get more people doing embedded programming with what I believe to be a better tool. And apparently, certainly, I mean, my efforts haven't been totally in vain. People are still using C++, and I still have a growing client base, but this overall trend is not pleasing. And so I want to talk about this. Is, you know, do we care about it, and what do we want to do about it? Well, so some of you are saying, oh, this is not my domain, so what's this to me? You know, we could just let the market take care of this, right? People will, if C++ is indeed the better tool, those of us who are using it will produce better, more timely, cost-effective products, and those who are not, well, that's the magic of free markets. But there are a lot of you from whom this is very personal, that the fact that you can't use C++ to the extent you would like, that you're forced to go back and use C, you know, you don't want to wait for the market to take care of this. You'd like to take some proactive steps to be able to make more of the people who should be using C++ willing to use it. And so this is why I think I'm here, is that, you know, CppCon is a project of the C++ Foundation whose stated goals are to support the C++ software developer community and promote the understanding and use of modern C++. And my feeling is, yeah, I want to be part of that. Me too, even if I'm the bearer of some unpleasant news, because it doesn't go away, we got to face it. So let's start by defining the problem. And here's what I think a concise statement of the problem is, that C++ isn't thriving in application domains where it should be thriving. And that there are C programmers who should be using C++ who aren't. Now again, I'm always introspective about this stuff. There is a legitimate argument to be made that those people who naturally do not gravitate to C++, if we bring them along and their skills actually aren't up to using C++, they're going to add to the history of bad experience that possibly got us where we are. So maybe we want to be a more selective crew. That's an open question. But I'm going to assume that, you know, we, you know, most of us are here because we know at a certain level that using C++ is better than C. And so I want to address the solution on that assumption. So it seems like maybe is it just do a better job of getting the word out? Is that what we need to do? And I think that's it, but it's not in the way that I think many of you think we need to go about doing it. I'm about to take you on a couple of little detours that some of you may find surprising, but I sort of have a cap. Give me a little leeway. Don't walk out on me. And I think you'll be interested in the outcome. So here's a cautionary tale about conveying messages, which is that in May of 2020, I wrote a column for Embedded Systems Design in which I was showing my readers how to represent memory map devices in C. And what I did was explored a variety of alternatives and ultimately came to the conclusion that using structures of all the alternatives in C appeared to be the best way to do it. And then I follow that up with a June column, which explained why C++ classes, are, I think, are even better at doing the same task. And what I want to convey to you here is that the interaction with my readers I found to be very enlightening, and the interaction with the C++ community was enlightening as well. So let me just show you the, I got to throw in a little bit of code here, otherwise I wouldn't be doing my job, I guess. So just to put us all on the same page, what I'm talking about is the situation where you have memory mapped device registers, things that look like memory locations, but they reside at specified addresses chosen by the hardware. In this case, I happen to have a set of three registers representing the interface to a timer. And this is what I showed different ways to model in C. And as I said, I came down on the side of favoring a structure, something very clean and neat, but rudimentary like that. I think that's the preferred way to do this sort of thing in C. My readers responded with, yes, this is great. Tell us more. We need more people showing us refined techniques for doing this sort of thing. So I said, me? Okay. Next month, I'll show you how to do something even better. We'll do it as a class. And the class, again, for many of you will be unsurprising. It's just got a public interface, which defines some useful interface constants or types. It's got some functions like enable, disable, set, and get to query the timer. And then it has a private body, which is nothing more, essentially, than the struct. And these days, we know this as a standard layout type. It has the same storage layout, the same structure, physical structure, as the C structure. And so you can do something like this. There's a little dagger at the bottom. There are some details that I have glossed over, but for the most part, you can do these things with confidence, that you can get this to map properly in memory and treat it like it's a class placed in a physical location on the bus. So what was the response? Well, some of my readers loved it. They said, yeah, keep going, you're on a roll. But there were others who made claims about a performance penalty. And we run into this all the time, the myths of somehow or another morphing a class, a non-polymorphic class, out of a struct is somehow going to give you these performance penalties. That's what seems to be a widespread belief still. So my response was, well, I know you're wrong, but I don't have the proof. I never did the measurements. I never did the science. And so I said, let's get it. Let's actually go out there and get it. And so I spent the next several months writing a series of columns. It ballooned in the entire rest of the year was one column after another on how to go about making these measurements. Highly unusual for a trade publication. But I did it because I thought it was the right thing to do. And I came up with what I thought was an exhaustive set of criteria. I said, let's explore the alternatives of C versus C++, or whether we use a monostate or a polystate design for the register, for the actual representation of the class, and whether or not the functions are inlined or not when you go to access the registers. And then there was a wide variety of ways you could actually place the data in memory, and accessing it through a pointer or a reference, or using scripting with the linker, using external declarations, and then using the linker to place the thing there. I tried all those different combinations, and it's all laid out. There's the title of the article, Measuring Instead of Speculating. So you could use a search engine and find it fairly quickly if you're interested. And I used three different compilers of different vintages because I wanted to be able to find out, is the impression one that was formed by using two old compilers, or is it that this is common across? Actually, I used a compiler that was developed in 2010, another one that was vintage 2004, and another one that was the year 2000, I think, and a fairly old compiler. And here, by the way, I actually did send this out. You know, most of the stuff that appears in the trade press isn't peer-reviewed. It just goes from author to the magazine or to the web, and the reviewers are the readers who get to rip it apart. And I thought, maybe I ought to run it by some experts first, so I found a few colleagues who were willing to look at it, and they all said, I think your method's basically sound. In fact, my business partner, Steve Dewey, he thought, wow, there's nothing like this out there. This is going to make a real splash. You know, people are going to be able to point to your article and say, see, this is the results, the comparative results of C and C++. And so in December of 2010, I published the results, and here they are. Here's a summary of one of the compilers. And let's take a little time here to take this apart. What I found was, top line says, either language, any design, whether it's monostate, polystate, all of that was neutralized by one factor, inlining. Both C and C++ yielded identical performance in my measurements, and all came out the fastest if you inlined. What was interesting, what happened was, if you couldn't use inlining, if the function complexity had reached the point where the functions were not inlined, this one surprised me. I really didn't expect this to happen, was that across the board with the compilers, the C++ outperformed the C. Now, what I expected was that I'd have to do the usual apology that, yeah, it's more costly, but it's worth it. But in this case, it turned out there was no apology to be had, that it was just better. Now, that's the nice thing about you, going into an experiment, not really knowing what the results will be. As Yogi Berra once said, you can observe a lot just by watching. And the interesting thing is, at the bottom there was one particular design, what I call the unbundled monostate pattern. The bundled and unbundled there is short for a bundled and unbundled monostate. And I wrote an article with that title because I looked through the literature and I couldn't find anybody making the subtle distinction that I wanted to make about the manner in which it was packaged. And it turned out that the unbundled monostate was the poorest for both languages, but still C++ did better at the poorest of the designs than C did. So what was the reader response? Now remember, you bear in mind what the curves looked like for the readership. This is a readership that's 60% C programmers. And the response, not surprisingly, was mostly negative, is that show me all the data you want, C++ is still undesirable. Yeah. So somebody said, let's read this. It's not instructive because the class you are using is far too simple. In other words, just using C++ to build lightweight classes is somehow or another not an appropriate use of C++. I run into this one several times. Many times, where people say, if you're not using all the whiz-bang features, virtual functions and inheritance and all that stuff, you're somehow or another not writing good C++. But then they say, but because of that, C++ has inferior performance to C. And I say, well, boy, how do I get myself out of that knot? You know, at the same time, the other C++ encourages people to make complex inheritance overriding while C does not. Well, right there, I just wrote you an article that's not encouraging you to do that. Some of them were actually very puzzling comments, like C++ hides the effects from you while doing the same thing and C does not. Yeah? And this is supposed to be bad? Now, how about the C++ community response? You know, people who are not avid readers, but my colleagues or former colleagues in the C++ community, the response was absolute dead silence, nothing. No emails, hey, nice article, we could use this. Just dead silence. And I later found out why. And it was a couple of years later that Dr. Dobbs' journal, may it rest in peace, was owned by the same publication that published embedded.com. And so they had rights to publish stuff that had previously appeared in embedded.com, and the editor started selecting some of my stuff from embedded.com and putting it up on Dr. Dobbs' journal. And the first one of those was an article I wrote on storage layout for polymorphic objects. And what happened was, I forget what it was, but maybe then somebody in the C++ community wrote me a congratulatory note, and I went and checked out the posting, and it was the blog notice on isoCPP.org said, "It's great to see Dan writing about C++ again." And in fact, I hadn't stopped. I had been writing for the last 15 years. I was just doing it in a venue that was somehow or another sequestered from the rest of the community, the embedded community. You know, here I was. I had this illusion that I was semi-famous still. You know, I'd go to the Embedded Systems Conference and people would think I'm a rock star. You know, I would talk to packed houses. And yet I did not realize the extent to which I had isolated myself from what I regarded as the mainstream C++ community. You know, they didn't know what I was doing. And some of that's my fault. You know, I wasn't communicating. I thought I was, but I thought people would just see it pop up on the web and, oh, there's another interesting article by Dan, but it wasn't happening. So anyway, I want to talk about this for a moment, but before we, don't want you to forget, when it comes to persuasion, if you're arguing, you're losing. I'm going to connect that up. So that's today's important lesson. So what to do? Let's return to the problem statement. Again, the C++ isn't thriving in applications domains where it should be. And C programmers who should be using C++ are not. That's what I think it is. And I will say this is not a technical problem. Observe the second law of consulting. How no matter how it looks at first, it's always a people problem. It's not a technical problem. Now, basically, the problem is a matter of too much misinformation. But the problem is that misinformation has festered for so long, it's a lot worse than you think it is. You know, and so you know, basically, I don't have any silver bullets here. I want to articulate a problem. I want to suggest some routes we can follow as a community. But you know, I need your help, obviously. I'm not succeeding at trying to make C++ more palatable to this particular segment of the market. Now, what I'm about to tell you has a lot to do with the fact that I live in Ohio. Now, interestingly, you know, Ohio is not known as a high-tech mecca for this particular market. People are often surprised that that's where I live. I make a living flying around delivering courses and the criteria, best criteria. I live near a small, easily accessible airport, so it really doesn't matter. But the other thing is a lot of people are surprised because, well, they say, you don't really sound like you're from Ohio, but then again you do. Because actually I grew up in New Jersey, and if you listen carefully, you will hear I skew my vowels the way somebody from New Jersey would. It's very subtle, because after many years in Ohio, I've made a conscious effort to sound like an Ohioan, but I haven't succeeded completely. In particular, when I grew up, that was an orange, and now it's an orange. And that was a quarter, and now it's a quarter. But this is, I will only blend in so far. Which is, I think those words are pronounced Mary, Mary, and Mary. But if I were from the Midwest, I think they're Mary, Mary, Mary. Notice, though, that Midwesterners at least have the courtesy to capitalize Mary when they're mispronouncing it. So So why am I talking about this? Well, if you're paying any attention to current events, you know that Ohio is a battleground state, which is a shorthand way of saying that unless you live in Florida, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, or Michigan, my vote counts a lot more than yours. And so the consequence is, as an Ohioan, that we're bombarded by campaign ads, much more so than the rest of you are. And some people respond by tuning it out. They say, you know, I can't hear you. But some of us respond by increased engagement. And this is how Ohio has influenced me, as I've responded by increased engagement. And it has affected my life in profound ways. It has affected the way in which I not only view politics in general, the world, but my profession. And that's what I'm going to connect up here, if you give me a few minutes. By the way, one of the perks of being politically active in Ohio is you get to meet interesting people. And interesting people. By the way, the interesting person on the left is my wonderful wife, Nancy. And the reason why I wear my hair unfashionably long is it made Joe jealous. Anyway, here's the thing that has affected my life as I've become a student of voter behavior. And here is, there's a lot of stuff that is a little dismaying in this. This talk is about to become depressing. And I'm sorry about that, but it's interesting, though. And for the most part, voters don't make rational decisions based on self-interest. We're not rational actors. That instead, we make emotional decisions driven by our worldview, our moral sense, and our cultural identity. And this voter behavior generalizes into people behavior, that people make personal and professional decisions based largely on emotional rather than rational factors. Where I'm headed with this is talking about C++ to C programmers. And the thing is that software engineers are people too. You know, we like to think we're not, but. So yeah, this is a talk. We're about to delve into people skills, and yeah, I know you're out there saying, if I cared about people skills, I wouldn't be writing software for a living. Pardon? Yeah, well, I'm going to try to stay away from that because I may lose half of my audience if I start staking out a position here. But so how do we know the things that I'm about to explain to you? And there's a lot of science in this. Now, yeah, it's social science, psychology, it's political science, stuff like that, but it is science. And we'll get there in a second, but I don't want you to remember just one thing, and what is that? Yeah, if you're arguing, you're losing. Yeah, and so what I'm about to talk about here is a combination of these various fields, which, by the way, I spend an awful lot of my discretionary time doing this. It's fascinating. And I will tell you that I wish I had known a lot of this when I was younger. I think it would have helped both my professional career and my personal life in a number of ways to be more aware of human behavior. Because I was pretty blind to this when I was younger. And like as Bobby was saying, you know, I was a hard ass as a teacher, and I'm not sure it served me. I mean, in Bobby's case, I guess it served him well, but you know, that doesn't always work so well in life. It reminds me of a line from the movie Harvey, where Elwood P. Dowd said, in life you can be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. For years I was smart, I recommend pleasant. And so here's one of the things that the science tells us this, and this is just one rendering of it. This pops up all over the place, which is, this is from Jonathan Haidt, who has a couple of really good TED Talks if you're into that stuff. And there's websites on moral foundation theory. But basically, it's all based on the fact that the mind is divided like a rider on an elephant, and the rider's job is to serve the elephant. In other words, the elephant goes whichever way it wants, and the rider's job is to explain why that was the rational choice. And to a varying degree, we all do this. We make gut-level decisions, and we use our intellect to justify those decisions. And this is also known in the biz as motivated cognition or post hoc reasoning. And here's another manifestation of it. This is from George Lakoff, cognitive scientist at Berkeley. He's mostly into the linguistic aspects of this stuff. He says, the myths begin with the Enlightenment, and the first one goes like this: the truth will set us free. If we just tell people the facts, since people are basically rational beings, they'll all reach the right conclusions. But we know from cognitive science that people don't think that way. This stuff, now let's start applying this in a more concrete way. There's a project at Yale called the Cultural Cognition Project. There are no books associated with this as far as I know, but it's a big website with lots of scholarly papers and other websites. And again, they come to the conclusion that people base moral, political, and philosophical decisions on a pair of competing worldviews. And so this is their cognitive model, that people, you know, by the way, psychologists love quadrants, you know, these 2 degrees of freedom. And in this case, their 2 degrees of freedom are that people are basically fall into the categories of being individualist versus communitarian, which is basically an individualist means it's somebody who believes, buddy, you're on your own. And communitarians believe we're all in this together. And egalitarians versus hierarchists, the egalitarians say, you know, we all more or less deserve equal treatment. And the hierarchists believe, but some are more deserving than others. They like the idea of a stratified society. They think it reflects a meritocracy. And this is what they found, is that cultural cognition affects what you fear. Okay? That depending upon what your belief system is, your underlying cultural view, you will regard certain things as genuine risks in your life and other things as not serious threats. So for example, in the upper left quadrant, you have people who are hierarchist and individualist, and they tend to think that involuntary HPV vaccination is a threat to society, as is gun control. But guns themselves, climate change, nanotechnology, don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. Whereas at the other end, it's just the opposite. In other words, the set of things we fear depends very much on where we start out in life in terms of our worldviews. Now, why am I telling you this? Where am I headed with this? Is that the things that the C++ community regards as things to be concerned about are dramatically different than the things that the C community is concerned about. And that when you're trying to communicate with people, it doesn't matter so much what your concerns are. If you're not addressing their concerns, you're not going to have a meeting of the minds. And so I'm using, so do I have proof that this sort of modeling applies in these computing problems? No, I don't. But my life experience tells me, yeah, software engineers are people, my friend. And these kinds of factors are at play. We just need to discover what they are and learn to apply them. There's another paper by Kahan et al. About motivated numeracy. And this one, it's just a head shaker. They found, here's what they did. They gave an experiment where they first showed people some statistical results on the effectiveness of using a skin cream to prevent a rash. And they asked the subjects to interpret the data. Does using this cream improve or worsen your odds that the rash will be cured? And they mixed up the data by changing the labeling and gave it to different sets of data and plotted how people were able to interpret that data. And then what they did was they relabeled it about gun control, about whether or not gun control laws increase or decrease crime in an urban area. And they gave the same people this, you know, the same data, relabeled, and what they found was that otherwise numerate people who could interpret data were likely misunderstand the data if understanding it challenged what they already believed. This is what we're up against. You know, it was, this is why after doing those articles for embedded.com, I actually got, you know, nobody said, hey, I was wrong. You're right, look at the data. Instead, they gave me reasons why my data wasn't valid. Reminds me of this quote from Jonathan Swift, that reasoning will never make a man correct an ill opinion, which by reasoning he never acquired. Here's one other aspect, which is that this is, a lot of it is based on the work of George Lakoff at Berkeley. People think in frames. A frame is a mental structure that shapes the way you view the world. Frames are often metaphors, they're implied comparisons. And what they do is they make comparisons between things that seem like they're unlike, but actually have something in common. Let me illustrate that with some examples. Morality is a very intangible entity, yet we talk about it by constructing an analogy with things like currency. For example, if you do me a favor, I'm now in your debt, I owe you one. And so we talk about moral exchanges as an exchange of money. Another common frame is to think of morality as height, where we use, say, somebody is a fine, upstanding young man, meaning height is good. To be tall is to be moral. And that if you want to get down and do immoral things, you're down in the dirt, you're down low. Altitude, height is morality. Now I'm going to connect this up with politics, and I'm going to connect this up with computing, which is that language choice actually skews political debate. I'm doing this for illustrative purposes, not to get you hot under the collar. Here's an example. This is a really good one. You hear politicians talk about tax burden or tax relief. This is a wonderful frame for skewing the debate in a given direction, because what does it do? When you juxtapose anything with the word burden or relief, what does that say about the something? It's an affliction. It's something that is bad. And that anybody who relieves you of that is a good person, and anybody who tries to do otherwise is a bad person. What it does, next time you're listening to a debate about taxation, listen to the wording they use, because this immediately frames it as taxes are bad and tax cutters are inherently good people. Now, that may be a good position, but I'm saying is language skews the debate. Right to work. If you know anything about labor laws, this is commonly cited phrase. What does this do? Well, who could be against the right to work? Evil unions. Unions are an oppressive force because they're trying to stop people from working. Now, is that an accurate characterization? That's the subject of another talk. But this is framing in action. All communications are framed. Using a frame reinforces it. And negating a frame is using a frame. When Richard Nixon said, the people want to know whether their president is a crook, well, I'm not a crook, people heard, I'm a crook. When people are trying to work against labor right to work laws and they say so-called right to work, that's using the frame. So-called fades away into nothingness. That's framing theory. You can't turn off a frame, you can only replace it with another frame. And replacing frames is very hard work. And that's where we're headed with this, is that C programmers live in certain frames regarding C++. And we have a chore to reframe this. But again, if you remember just one thing, if you're arguing, you're losing. So, Let's talk about what one of the many frames is that C++ C programmers live in. Here's one that I've encountered, which is, let's illustrate it with a little bit of code. The memcopy function. Hard to write any meaningful C without dabbling into stuff like this frequently. And it's great. It copies one array to another. It worked for arrays of doubles as well as arrays of integers. It'll even work for arrays of structs of any size. What's not to like? Well, the problem is you can easily mismatch the types of the arguments and wind up copying something that's got the bit pattern of a double into an int. You can easily get the array bounds wrong and wind up overwriting the array. See, what we know is that C code will compile all sorts of bugs, more so than most languages, and C programmers know this and accept this. This is the world that they live in. So it breeds a very unfortunate mindset, which is, let's just get the code to compile so we can get to the real work, which is debugging. You laugh, but it's real. It was contrived to make you laugh. I mean, it is. This is a frame. The real work is debugging is a frame, a frequently employed frame by C programmers. Now, they're not going to come out and tell you this. Now, that's the nature of frames, is that they're substructures of the mind. People use them. And once you know about this stuff, you listen differently to people. You try to, okay, what's the... They're saying things that don't sit right with me. They're looking at it from a different viewpoint. But if you just come head on and tell them why they're wrong, what are you doing? You're arguing and you're losing. So you have to figure out, replace it with a different frame. That's what we need to do, is replace it with a different frame. Well, the problem is reframing is hard. It's really hard. It is an experiment, a trial and error process. You have to take your best guess, and then you have to try to see if your understanding of the situation helps you reframe and talk about it differently in a way that engages the other person. So let's try reframing the discussion about C, which is that, you know, we all know testing exposes bugs, debugging eliminates known bugs, but it doesn't demonstrate the absence of bugs. So we want something closer to a proof system. And so the alternative frame is to focus on the importance of strong type checking, that it turns potential runtime errors into compile time errors. And as such, they are much harder to ignore. It's hard to ship a program that has a compile error in it. It's easy to ship programs with runtime errors, right? Most customers will not accept source code with compile errors in it. Now, effective frames are short. That one is too long. You have to make it concise, like shorter type checking avoids bugs, something like that. And this is much more viable in C++ than it is in C. We all know that. Now, but here's an important underpinning to persuasion ethics, which is that effective persuasion is an emotional appeal. It's not a rational appeal. You have to make sure that you are addressing the other person's emotional needs. And the point is that an emotional appeal can be and should be a truthful appeal. The problem with a lot of political messaging is it's not. They don't care. They'll grab your emotions and not worry about your intellect. But I would be remiss if I didn't say, while we're doing this, we have to make sure that what we are advocating for people is not just emotionally appealing to them, but is intellectually justifiable to ourselves. And so I think an emotional appeal can and should have a basis in evidence and reason. And that's our obligation. That's our ethical obligation. Here's the problem with the strong type checking argument. Again, I would love to be wrong about this. If it turns out I am, you know, that's great. which is I did try searching to find how many published papers and articles that actually give real evidence, statistical evidence, stuff that we could say we know to a scientific certainty that this is a true proposition, that in fact, statically typed, strongly typed languages produce fewer software defects and lower life cycle costs. Now, there are a few, one or two studies out there, but not what I would consider to be a preponderance of evidence, okay, to be able to demonstrate that. And that's a failure on our part, our part, the community. I mean, I tried to do it with performance data in that study that I did, but boy, that was time consuming. I'm sympathetic to people who say, boy, I got a life to live. That's, you know, it's not my job to rectify that, but as a community, I think we have to start making this important, that we believe this to be true, we've experienced it ourselves, but it's anecdotal. It's largely anecdotal, as far as I can tell. I said, I'd like to be wrong, but... And so if there is such data out there, I would strongly encourage the foundation, somewhere at its website, at isoCPP.org, start putting those links up there, collecting it together, and start making the case. Now, remember, just trotting out the facts is not going to necessarily persuade people, but it's, if you have a receptive audience, it's information you can draw on. But here's the other problem, you know, if I haven't filled you with enough despair yet, this may be the most despairing thing I've learned in the last few years, which is that a couple of researchers, Brendan Nyhan and Jason Reifler, have identified something called the backfire effect, which is that telling misinformed people correct information can actually increase belief in the misinformation. There are lots of studies to show this. If you Google the backfire effect, you'll find lots of papers on this. You know, which says that if somebody believes something wrong and you tell them, no, here's the right information, they now believe the other information even more so. And it doesn't matter where the correcting information came from. They did experiments where they had people look at Fox News, you know, conservatives, avid Fox News viewers, looking at corrections about political misinformation, and the fact that it came from Fox didn't matter. These people still believed the misinformation that much. I'm picking on Fox. Same thing happened with MSNBC. So for a fact to be believed, it must fit an accepted frame. And it's very hard to unmoor existing frames. And that's the state we're in right now. And that's the, I'm not quite sure what to say other than a few suggestions at the end about how do we get ourselves out of this situation where so many people have an invalid frame about C++. So whatever you do, don't make it worse. If you're arguing, you're losing. That's a good way to make it worse. Here's the last of the factors I want to inject, which is there's something known as loss aversion. And from psychology and decision theory, it's now fairly well established that fear of loss is greater than the desire for gain. That, in fact, some studies indicate that fear of loss is roughly twice as important a psychological factor as the desire for gain. So that means, and advertisers know this, in fact, there have been psychological experiments done with things like if employers want employees to do things to keep their weight down or give up smoking, the question is, do you give them a bonus for exhibiting the behavior you want, or do you give everybody that and take it away from them if they don't exhibit the desired behavior? And it turns out it's better to give it and then take it away, because loss aversion is higher. People are not rational beings, are they? Now, this is a real problem for the C++ community, because how do we sell C++ to C programmers? We talk about the gains, right? Because the reality is the loss is very little, right? But you can't negate a frame. So when we say, and you can do all this, and it won't be any less efficient, what do you hear? It will be less efficient. You can't negate a frame. And again, this is a conundrum I'm not sure what to do about. As I say, reframing is hard. But this is the situation we've got ourselves in. So moving from C to C++ does require a change in mindset. And a particular concern I have is that the community is making that a little harder by setting a bar too high. In particular, it's the manner in which we're advocating the teaching of C++. Now, in defense of people who are advocating this position, I will say I'm not blaming any one person here or any group in specific. What I'm saying is this falls into the realm. Frank Luntz, who is a fairly well-known pollster and word advocate, in fact, Frank Luntz is the guy who coined the term tax relief and gave that to politicians as a consultant. He says, it's not what you say, it's what they hear. And there are a lot of people who are hearing that this is a one-size-fits-all approach. The modern approach to teaching C++, which is to use streams instead of files, vectors instead of arrays, strings instead of null-terminated character sequences. This is modern C++. This is what we've been striving for a long time, is to have these things compete very favorably, very, very favorably, with the things they replace. And I will agree that for non-C programmers, this is almost certainly the best approach. Although, again, I have no statistical data to verify that, it seems right to me. But long ago, C++ was billed as a better C. It's now being touted as a new language, and if you put yourself in the shoes of the person that you're talking to who's a C programmer, this raises dread. That's been my experience, that a key aspect of C++ that made it popular is now deprecated. I chose that specifically because that's the standard ease for it. Many C programmers moving incrementally from C to C++ is still probably much more practical. In fact, I specifically have clients who have hired me to teach them C. And I say, well, you know, you really want to learn C++. I said, well, but we want C. And in a number of cases, it was only after I established the credibility with them of letting them know that, yes, I hear you, that they finally said, you know, now we're ready to have you teach us C++. And I don't gloat. I just say, okay, fine, I'll do it. You know, of course, I go back and, yes. And I had a very fascinating conversation. I spoke at the Flight Software Workshop in Baltimore last year. And after I spoke about using C++, they specifically invited me to speak there, the conference organizers, because they knew that I was aerospace. A lot of those people were from NASA. C is the lingua franca. There's very little C++. And they wanted me to come in and basically show the audience what they were missing. And I had one person, after I spoke, come up to me and say, you know, we've tried several times to integrate C++ into our work. We have a sizable C code base, lots of C programmers, and we brought in people, and they start giving us vectors and maps and things like this, and we don't know how to integrate it into the culture and the code base. It's too far away. We tried hiring some master's students, people who just recently got master's degrees, to come on the job and help us. And we eventually had to say, stop using C++ and use C. The culture gap was too wide. I said, that's tragic. That's tragic. So unfortunately, the best may be the enemy of the better. It's easy to lose sight of the fact that we got where we are in C++ by an evolution of 25, 30 years. This is from Dale Carnegie, which, although this is a 80-year-old book, it's still, this is great stuff. There's only one way under the high heaven to get anybody to do anything. Did you ever stop to think about that? Yes, just one way, and that is by making the other person want to do it. Remember, there is no other way. Okay, you can't reason them into it. It says, and the other one is, so the only way on earth to influence other people is to talk about what they want and show them how to get it. So that means that when you are talking to people that you would like to persuade, You don't start by leading with your version of the facts. They don't care about that. What they want to know is, do you understand where I am and what my problems and concerns are? So your job is to ask questions. We're very bad at that. It requires people skills, it requires listening. And I say, learn it. Embrace it. It will make you better as a person, not just as a programmer. Find out what your colleagues want out of their software, identify specific actionable goals and concerns, and then figure out how to align them with your goals. If your goal is, I would like to be able to use C++ more freely within my work, I would like to be able to have other people provide me APIs in C++ and not in C. You want to align what their concerns are with your concerns. And this is important. You ask them, what can I do, one, to allay your concerns and to help you get where we want to be, where you want to be, where we want to be. You don't just goad them into it. You don't just belittle them, you C programming morons. That's not going to help. And of course, this is your fundamental life lesson, folks. Let's hear it. If you're arguing, you're losing. That's right. So here is the other concrete technical suggestion I'm going to end with. This will take us through the end of the talk, which is, I think the best thing you can do, by the way, I think this will just make you a better C++ programmer, even if you're not talking to C programmers. I do a lot of C++ teaching, and during the course of my lectures, I often ask people, we use the term data type very frequently in our discussion. How would you define a data type? You know what? I know what it is. I feel it at a gut level. That's not enough. You have to be able to articulate your understanding of a data type in a very conscious way. Because if you bring that to the forefront of your thinking, you will realize that it affects the way you design classes. It affects the way you design interfaces. And so I'm going to take a stab at it here, and you have my permission to borrow and improve upon this phrasing. So C and C++ use static data typing. An object's declaration determines its static type. I mean, I'm about to tell you a bunch of things you all know. What I want to do is give you a way to articulate it to other people. That's the purpose of this discussion. And the static type doesn't change during program execution. See, by the way, why am I talking about this? Because this, the world out there, the C world, when you ask them what's the difference between C and C++, they start talking about the things that are high up and far away. The STL, templates, metaprogramming, inheritance, virtual function. You know what I say it is? It's the fundamental concept of the type system. Okay, that's really, and that's at a level that they can grok. You know, that we're reframing their understanding of the language. It's a fundamentally different view of the paramount importance of the type system and what you do. And I think it's really helpful for C++ programmers to become really conscious of that. So how does that benefit you? Well, here's stuff that just, you get it in C too, is the type system is what facilitates overloading, built-in overloading. It's through the recognition that even 42 has a type, it's a signed int, that the compiler can look at that and determine, oh, what is the interpretation of that plus operator? Is it an integer add, an unsigned integer add? Is it a floating add? You just write add, the compiler takes care of the rest. But it's because it's carrying around that type information inside the compiler. So what is a data type? Here's how I would define it. It's a bundle of compile time properties, largely compile time. You know, in C, it's compile time properties. In C++, a little bit of runtime, but let's just start here, which is things like size and alignment. That's the mechanical stuff. Here's really where that, it's a set of valid values, and it's a set of permitted operations, okay? And I'm doing this because I've asked this of many, many C++ programmers teaching intermediate and advanced courses, and I say, what's a data type? And they flounder a little, they hem and haw. And then I tell them this, and they say, oh yeah, what you said. And what I'm saying is, if you want to be good at making the case for C++, You want to be articulate about this, really articulate about it, with a sense of purpose. So for example, in the case of the type int, typical machine, a 32-bit processor, size and alignment is 4. The range of values, you know what that is, and it's integers only, and then there's a set of operations that are permitted. But just as important as the set of operations that are permitted are the set of operations that are not permitted. What are the things you can't do with an int? You can't dereference it. You can't use member selection on it. You can't call it like it's a function. And this is true for all of the types. It's a set of permitted and not permitted operations. And then, of course, there's a set of implicit conversions. And this is a source of a lot of misunderstanding. Let me illustrate it with this, my favorite example. I'd love to give this question, which is, if you were writing a compiler, a C compiler, or maintaining a C compiler, and you ran the C compiler under the control of a debugger, and you set a breakpoint so that right after it reads the declaration of that local variable, you could inspect the description of X that was entered into the symbol table. And what would you see as the type of X? And it's remarkable how many people say it's a pointer. Okay. A lot of people, I just do this over and over again in my teaching, and a lot of experienced C++ programmers say it's a pointer. And in truth is, it's an array with 10 elements of type int. And that, of course, raises the question, well then, who lied to me? That's really the question. Who lied to me and told me it was a pointer when I thought it was that? And it's because of this question, why does that compile? Why can you take an array and assign it to a pointer? It's because of this phenomenon we call array decay, is that there's a built-in array to pointer conversion. And here is the real lesson, which is that the decay is momentary. Now, in the case of arrays, it happens so often that people are easily hoodwinked into thinking that arrays are pointers. But I think there's a direct analogy here, which is that when you add a double plus an int, we all say it converts I to a double, but that's a shorthand. It's a shorthand for it creates a temporary object of type double, converts I, puts it in there, and then uses the double for the expression, and then throws it away. After the expression is over, is I a double? No. And the problem with arrays is that all you have to do is look at it cross-eyed that says, okay, I'm a pointer. So often that people get thinking arrays are pointers, but the real lesson here is that there's a fundamental difference between the type something really has and the type it acquires by implicit conversions. And being able to talk about that knowledgeably and clearly all of a sudden makes your ability to discuss things like overloading and type deduction and stuff like that much, much less mysterious to your intended audience. It also makes it clearer to you. And by the way, it makes compiler error messages actually fathomable. Now, of course, there's a little twist in the story, which is that an array declared as a parameter immediately decays to a pointer, right? Even when you write array declarations, its inherent type is. So notice that in the previous example, I had a local variable of type array, and now I'm distinguishing it with array parameters. Now, again, who uses arrays anyway? We're aspiring to a world where people aren't using these things, but you're talking to C programmers. And C programmers live and breathe arrays. And if you walk in there and say, you're doing it all wrong, here's a vector. Good luck. So it really does help you to approach it this way. That's been my experience. That's how I've established credibility with a great deal of my clientele. The other thing about type information is that it helps prevent accidents. You know this too, is that basically what it does is it turns, it's useful information at compile time, which turns potential runtime errors into compile time errors. And you want to emphasize this because this, I think, is a frame that you want to focus on. always bring this up, you know, Scott, I think this may have been Scott's best line ever. Make interfaces easy to use correctly and hard to use incorrectly. And clearly memcopy doesn't satisfy that criteria because it's neither easy to use correctly nor hard to use incorrectly. And again, what was it about memcopy that isn't all that easy to use correctly? Well, you have to make sure you pass the right size. It would be much easier if you could do that, and it would be even better if you could do that. But you can't. Well, you know you can by redeclaring it as an array template, but that's a tough sell. So again, the real problem with memcopy is that it invites errors. And if you really, really insist on doing this stuff in C, it turns out an interesting thing about pointers to arrays is they don't decay into pointers to pointers. That even in C, parameters of a pointer to array type retain their arrayness. So in theory, you could write a bunch of functions in C that do the bounds checking at compile time. But you have to write an awful lot of functions. It never ends because the language doesn't have overloading and it doesn't have templates. And so it's not a scalable solution. Whereas in C++, as you all know, you can write a function template because the array dimension is part of the type. If you bind a reference to an array, it doesn't decay either. And this is a commonly used programming technique in C++ when you're dealing with arrays to be able to pass an array by reference and therefore deduce its array dimension. And you can write an array copy which actually checks that the two array dimensions are the same. This array copy will give you a compile time validation. And so that becomes easy to use correctly and hard to use incorrectly. Now, if for some reason memcopy isn't faster than array copy, if somebody discovers, oh, your array copy is costing me time, it's slower than memcopy, you can just wrap it. And the problem with that is, what about types other than the built-in types? Well, you can put in a static check for that. Now, you could start going the route, I guess, of using svna and enable if you want to scare people off. I would say stick with this. This is within the comprehension of somebody who's skittish about this stuff. That's been my experience. So again, you know, I understand for many of you, making built-in array copies safer is probably not your concern because you're going to use a vector. But for many C programmers, this is a real concern. And this is the sort of incremental approach that my experience tells me it still works. This is how you talk to C programmers. You recognize that they're in a frame that they think debugging is where it's at. And if you can relieve them of that burden, they might look kindly on you. So what are some possible future directions here? One is we have to decide if we as a community care about this, to actually take some action. It matters to me because this is the market segment that I've chosen to work in. And what we should do is assess the potential gain in market share. In other words, do we want to do this? Do we think we can win over? Now, I don't know if this is within the realm of the resources of the foundation to do things like this, but could we be doing surveys of people to find out, are you using C? What are your reasons for sticking with C? What are the inhibiting factors? What could the foundation do to make this more inviting? We want to identify that. You know, I have conjectures. I have personal experience about what I think those inhibiting factors are, but my periscope isn't up that high. You know, it's high enough for me to serve my clients, but I don't really have that view of the entire industry, so I'm certainly open to other people giving feedback on this. And then, of course, we have to decide what, if any, actions we want to do that are appropriate and feasible. The last thing I'll mention to you is, you know, I've been decrying the lack of rationality in this discourse. I've been telling you, if you want to deal with people, you have to, I'm not going to say they're psychological tricks, but you just have to understand that people are not rational actors. And, you know, wouldn't it be nicer if we were a little bit more rational? And so I'm going to end by asking you to, why don't we start down that path a little? You know, if any audience is capable of doing that, you guys are. And so, you know, take a moment to reflect. Like, try this the next time somebody presents you with something that you doubt or find objectionable. Is instead of saying, here's why you're wrong, as you would post on Facebook, ask, how can we verify this? Notice the we there. How can we verify this? Is there credible evidence already to back this up? If not, is there a testable hypothesis in there somewhere? Something we, and is it feasible to test it? And in the absence of that kind of testing, how would we proceed rationally? Try it sometime. You might like it. It's better than what? Arguing and losing. So what's today's lesson? If you're arguing, you're losing. If you don't remember anything else, that's it. And thank you for indulging me. Okay. You have a question?
Question.
Yes.
So you start off with, you know, the premise that maybe you're starting a conversation with someone who's in doing C and they've come to you.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you do it the other way around? How do you approach them? Because you're sort of, you know, all of your stuff about going into their frame, sort of you're going into their frame, you're being sort of, I wouldn't say combative by approaching somebody, but how do you approach programmers to make them better C programmers?
Well, it's by asking questions. Okay, you don't want to come in there and tell them what your agenda is, right? Unless they ask. I mean, gee, you never spoke to me before. What do you want? Why are you interested in me now? And you can think about a polite answer to that that's accurate. But what you want to do is ask them about what are your concerns? What are the problems that you're running into? By the way, I'll mention, my experience with the purveyors of compilers for the embedded market. When I used to go to the embedded systems and go to the booths at the trade shows, and I'd say, you know, how are you coming along with your implementation of C++ 11? Like, for example, I just downloaded the latest, greatest compiler from IAR, who is a not insignificant player in that field. That C++ compiler does not support any C++ 11 features. And you say, well, what are they spending their time on? And the answer is, it's the back end. It's the tools for debugging and analysis and the support of, you know, platform-specific needs in embedded development. And that's what that market cares about. They're trying to cater to their needs. You want to find out what your colleague, what are their and see if you can find, you know, reflect before you shoot from the hip as to what would be a common ground, you know, for my needs, and see if you can steer the conversation that way. There are actually books on how to do this in general, not in programming, but if you, one of the ones that I read was called Changing Minds, The Art of Influence Without Manipulation. And he actually gives you a step-by-step, you know, model for the sort of queries that one should ask if your intent is to open up a dialogue that will eventually lead to changing somebody's mind. The book is by a gentleman named Rob Jolles, J-O-L-L-E-S. But that's just one of many such books. That happened to be the one that I met Rob. He gave me a free copy of his book, and so now I get to plug it for him. Over there.
How to get them like interested in templates, which is something which doesn't really exist in C, though they should not have like a already set frame there.
Well, that's why I gave the little example with the array copy template, very small, lightweight, dealing with a data structure that your C programmer can readily grok. You know, they can and frame it in the context of what we're trying to do is take a very common error that's encountered in C programming, which is an array bounds overflow, and try to turn that into something that can be checked at compile time. And so that's why I showed that little template example and contrasted it what you had to do with by brutally handwriting a whole bunch of C functions. That was one such experiment. I'm sure that with a little thought we could come up with other lightweight templates. One example that I use in my other writing is that there is no native concept in either C or C++ of a write-only data type. Right? You can use const to have read, but there's no write-only attribute. But you can easily craft a small, lightweight class, which I have published in my column, on how to impose write-only semantics on a data type. And you can easily demonstrate that it has the same performance as it would have if you stripped away the write-only class and wrote direct and accessed the thing directly. And it's those kinds of lightweight little things that fit easily into their programming paradigm for which templates are really good. And I would focus on that.
Yeah, hi. This is my professional life. I've tried and failed many times myself, and I even know about some of this research. But one of the things that a C programmer might actually say back to you is that C++ is hard and complex. And since I've worked with many, many people that will never grok enable if it takes their whole lives, what do I do then?
Sometimes you just can't win, you know? That's you part of life is recognizing when you lost and go on somewhere else. You know, you may not have the freedom to change jobs or whatever, but, you know.
No, I just did change, actually, so. Oh. I guess I followed your advice without knowing.
Yes. That is an aspect, that is another frame in which C programmers live, which is that the C++ language is inordinately more complicated than C. And unfortunately, that's true, right?
Yeah, I know.
And that it really, it comes from the perspective, there's another associated frame, which is the C programmer mindset is any programming language I'd be interested in is one I can teach myself. And the problem is that for many of these is people need some mentoring. You need a little guidance. There's aspects of C++ that are not self-evident. But you're coming from a culture dominated by double E's and computer engineers whose instructor wasn't interested in teaching them programming. They gave them a copy of K&R and here said, make those lights blink, right? That's their programming education. And so, again, what you have to do is find resources to lower that educational bar and make it to take the fear out of it. And, you know, that's what I'm hope. This conversation, I hope, will stimulate the community to give people like you a little bit more support.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Over there.
One of the main principles of C++ is zero-cost abstractions.
Yes.
But unfortunately, it's not true in debugging, in debug mode. And as you said, C programmers love to debug. And even in your example of copy array, it does additional call in debug. So what are your arguments for C programmers in that?
What you're saying is that when you're in debug mode,
yeah,
the code that's
compiling
generated,
without
it's different than the code that's in release mode, right?
Yeah. Well,
do you look in release mode? Does it optimize?
Of course, in release mode, it's free. But
right.
When you need to debug a lot, you do it without optimizations.
Yes,
and it's a huge concern for in community.
What is their concern? Can you?
Well, for example, I know there is in ESTL, STL, and one of its main feature that it is simpler for in and faster in debug mode. Well, it's really very bad when you compile your program without optimizations, and it's like 10 times slower then in release, and you can't.
My answer is I have to think about that. I'd be glad to talk to you, you know, offline, because I don't have a ready answer for that. You know, I'm.
Thank you.
Sorry. I mean, it's just. You know, I've long since gotten over my reticence about saying that, and I hope that doesn't shatter illusions that I don't have the answer to everything. Yes?
I have a question about problem ownership, because the owner of the problem is me. I have a problem that other person are using C instead of C++. That is my problem and not theirs, because they feel very fine by using C.
Yes.
So if I try to solve other person's problems, I experience that they feel remembered as their mommy trying to solve their problems when they were very, very little.
Yeah.
And they feel belittled by that. So what do you suggest to overcome this?
No, what you're saying, my understanding of what you're saying is that they're using C and not C++ is your problem,
that's
not their problem. They're perfectly content.
Yes.
Yes, and you are not likely to change them. The process of changing their minds, I mean, you can certainly ask them, what kinds of things are you encountering? And if you find, as your issues, like, you know, life can't be perfect, just strike up a conversation and see if you can find out. There may be something in there that you can work with, but it will be a very, very long, I mean, years to make that transition, and you have to have that kind of patience. And, you know, the other possible outcome is saying, this is just not the right working environment for me. That is a reality of this situation, I think, is that I don't think you can change their mind unless they want to have it changed. And if you think it's just your problem and not theirs, then it is your problem. It's sort of the C++ community's problem too, but, you know, but in this individual case, I'm not sure you're going to win, and you might have to accept that. Yes?
So I work in a code base where somebody actually tried to adopt smart pointers about 10 years ago, and they did it in kind of a naive way, passing them by value everywhere, and this turned out to have a measurable performance impact, and they ended up going back to raw pointers. Now, everybody in this room, I'm sure, is thinking, oh yeah, that's a completely avoidable problem. But in the meantime, a lot of people on the team still think that their first reaction to smart pointers is, oh yeah, we tried that once, it had a lot of overhead, let's not do that again. How do you talk to people that have tried C++ in some ways before and have been burned by it?
Yeah, what I was saying is that when a frame like that has been allowed to persist for years, undoing it, it's really, really tough. You know, and I feel your pain. But there's, you know, sometimes in life, you learn. One of the things that I've learned about this psychology is to do triage, which is you're talking to somebody who's unpersuadable. And all you can say is, have a nice life. And you know, I wish you well. I'm going somewhere else. But it always starts by asking questions. It asks, you know, finding out, yes, we tried. Do we wish it had succeeded? You know, is there a way that you could somehow or another figure, you know, through questioning, finding out where they are, to want them to give it another shot? Okay, and what can you do to help them see that, in fact, the situation has changed, we know more about them, we have better technology, it's worth a shot.
And thank you.
I think that's what you got to try. Yes?
So it seems like this was really good advice for if you find yourself in a situation where, you know, you're on a C project that's maybe considering C++, or if you are a consultant brought in to teach people how to use C++. And I know everyone's biography is unique, but I wonder if you could give a minute or maybe offline to say, how do you break into one of those situations in the first place? You know, I would love to find myself in that situation, but I haven't yet.
Where you have an opportunity?
This is good advice for evangelizing C++ to a certain audience.
Uh-huh.
I've never found myself in conversation with that
have
audience.
Have you always been surrounded by like-minded people?
Yeah. I mean, I've been surrounded by C++ people.
What's your complaint?
Well, you got me all fired up to go do this. I got no one to do it to. How do I find those
people? That's right. You want to put on your sandals and robe and go out into the wilderness and...
Do you have any advice on the subject?
We can take that offline.
Okay.
Yeah.
Broaden your friend base, Arthur.
Yeah.
Do you have a slide of resources and references?
On?
Like the research and the books you were talking about?
No, but I probably could email you that if you would, you know, it's dan@dansax.com, and I could, other people have asked me for that, and I could send you a bibliography.
I'll do that, thank you.
Yeah.
You mentioned working with the IAR compiler.
The question was, could I add that as a slide? That's probably a good idea. Yeah, that's a marvelous idea, thank you. Yeah, so I will do that. Yes.
I was asking,
excuse me, how are we doing on time here? Arbiters of the clock? Pardon? It's 12? I'm not anxious to go bolting out of here, so I'll continue to answer questions as long as we can have the room. Go ahead.
With regards to the IAR compiler, it is not the only one in the embedded sphere that does not support C++ 11, and I find that with some of the modern C++, people look at it kind of askew because, features, whatever, but it also comes with some improvements like the move semantics.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we, maybe as a community, better connect with compiler vendors for specific chips to kind of impress upon them that ISO CPP, 11, 14 have improvements that they should be interested in, not just, this nice syntactic stuff for lambdas and stuff, but maybe actual move semantics and
I think you have to just make more noise. I mean, in other words, they're responding to what their customer base says are the things they are most interested in seeing in the next product. And I think that people who are asking for richer back-end tools tended to be louder than the people who are asking for language features. And you would just have to turn up the 11 button.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hi, thanks for the talk, that was fantastic. Just one point that I think was maybe not addressed is in that trend of embedded systems developers grow more and more using C than C++. I think one issue is that new developers are introduced to C before C++. And I think that with the new modern C++, the barrier to entry is actually lower than it used to be.
Yes.
I think it was last year, Kate Gregory, that was saying, stop teaching C.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of things that we can do in the community to help people that are new to programming start with C++ instead of C. I mean, I remember when I started with C and then learned C++, and then I arrived in the field of embedded programming, and someone told me, take this course in Coursera, and of course, they teach it with C. We could have a course on C++ embedded development with C++, and that would help decrease the trend for C, increase for C++, not only evangelizing to C programmers, but get people in the boat in the first place. That would help a lot. So I don't know if you have any ideas on what we can do to do that.
Not really. I mean, I'm in that business, right? But I haven't yet found the business model that wants me to go put that stuff online yet, but I'm working on it. And so I guess that's my solution, is when I see a commercial interest in it, I will probably go that route.
Thank you.
Yes.
So I really love the talk. It reminded me of times where I discussed with C programmers who thought that abstractions were inherently harmful because they hide details that can reveal performance issues or that kind of stuff. So how is there any way I can break that frame of people thinking that abstractions are harmful because they hide details?
Oh, the question is, how do you break that frame that abstraction is harmful because
It hides details about performance and...
Yeah, see, the irony there is that for many, if you think debugging is where is at, the layers of abstraction that you, when you build classes, it's all about hiding details, which you want to see when you're debugging. And so I believe the right approach is to fully embrace what, you know, Scott Myers is, make interfaces easy to use correctly and hard to use incorrectly, which means that class interfaces have to defend themselves against abuse. That either you have to put the effort into making sure that there is much better compile time detection, or that the failures are very overt, and you clearly throw an exception or return something such that the user of those classes doesn't have to step their way through these layers of abstraction which make debugging harder. That's the reframing is subsidiary to the idea that strong typing turns, avoids bugs. And that's the frame you want to try to continue to reinforce. You have to do that collaboratively. They're not going to believe it until they can demonstrate it themselves on their own code. You want to help them with that.
Thank you.
Oh.
Do you have experience with using Qt on embedded?
No, I do not.
Because I hear that's getting very popular.
Oh, okay. No.
For interfaces and screens.
Okay.
So that might be also
I do not know. I cannot comment.
Okay.
Linus Torvalds is very famous for hating C++ in all caps. Any hope there?
Probably not.
Okay.
No, I mean, he believes what he believes, it's not likely that unless you know him personally and you can engage him in conversation, social media is not a good persuasion medium. It's the purpose of social media is to reinforce your own beliefs. Last one, I guess. Oh, next to last one.
Yes, I was wondering, would you consider a C++ to C transpiler as being something that would do service to allowing younger developers and people who are in fact interested in C++ but not allowed to use it in the workplace to gradually change the mindset by being able to use it on their own, or would it be a disservice on the opposite side?
That's an interesting question. That was the original C++ compiler. Was CFront was a C++ to C translator, and interestingly, it was often demeaned for not being a real compiler, and because it didn't generate real machine code, it was just a preprocessor. But I think that's a useful learning tool. Being able to, if people believe that they understand what C constructs do from there down to the machine, to show them how direct the mapping is for so many C++ constructs is actually an enlightening thing. But I'm not aware of such a contemporary tool that supports that right now.
Thank you.
Yes.
If someone wanted to get started in this market segment, but you have no background in embedded development, and you wanted to come in and do C++, it seems like that would be pretty difficult to kind of get into this field.
Yes.
Of embedded development. What are your recommendations of how to kind of get into that field if you wanted to do that?
Oh, are you already an avid C++
programmer? Yeah, I have 20 years of C++ experience, but... it's in a different kind. I've never done embedded development. I've actually applied for embedded development positions, but they immediately look at it and say, "Well, you don't have embedded," so I get turned away right away.
Yeah.
How do you break into that? And it seems very difficult if they're doing C, but you want to come in doing C++. It seems like a very difficult thing to break into.
Well, take everything I'm about to say with an awful lot of salt, because I've never done what you're describing. I've never applied for I haven't had a real job for 30 years. But If you want to teach yourself embedded, usually the route is to acquire one or more inexpensive evaluation boards. They usually can be, you know, the low-end ones, the Raspberry Pi and things like that, are dirt cheap. You can get slightly more sophisticated ones for $100, $200. And then you can usually get a decent tool chain with it. Now, expect that the programming examples that will be readily available to you will be written in C. And so you start out by dabbling with the stuff. You learn how to blink lights and respond to button pushes, mostly by looking at already written examples and playing with them, trying experiments. You gradually look at the data sheets, look at the specs. You may have to get out a book on electronics and read about some of the properties of the physical circuits to understand why is there a setting there for rising edge or falling edge triggering, and what does that stuff mean? You have to learn, you know, that lingo. But if you want to do a self-taught approach like that, it's usually a matter of buying some instructional kits. There's a company called the Bar Group that actually has something called, I think it's the embedded course in a box. They actually will sell you their course materials in a box, but again, it's teaching embedded programming largely using C. You will then have to take your C++ knowledge and leverage that, which is largely how I learned to use C++ in embedded, was take all those C examples and start translating them. Start applying templates and inheritance and things like that, namespaces, and see if I can render the same thing as efficiently as I could in C++ as in C. That's my best advice.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you.